Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, August 2nd, 2001. In the fireside room this morning is Christy Traina. Today's session number is TRC 2001-04, and it's titled The Grandeur of God, Poetry of Creation. Let's listen in.
Not from the point of view of argument, which is important, right? We need to parse things, we need to figure out strategies, we need to make policies, we need to make decisions. But another piece of eco-theology is eco-spirituality and developing images of God, developing images of God's relation to the world and images of our relationship to the world that have that resonate with our religion, with our spirituality. And usually in our lives, we need more than one image. We were talking yesterday about animal rights, and sometimes we need to think about animals as beings with rights that they shouldn't have unnecessary suffering inflicted on them. Other times we need to speak about preservation of species and not worry about that particular deer or this particular muskrat. Or that particular mosquito or a black fly. We need multiple images, and some of the images that we deal with today will resonate very strongly with some of you. Some of them you may find entirely repulsive and not useful, but we're going to explore some more poetic images of the world and God's relationship to it. Some things that you should know, most of you having been here a couple days probably know that if you can't hear me, you should ask me to be louder. And if you still can't hear me, there are assisted listening devices in the media center, which is just a couple steps down the hallway, and you're welcome to just dash out and get one and come right back. Also, if you're missing my husband's session next door, you can listen to it later on tape. So actually, you can bilocate. There are listening stations around the village. And you can also purchase a tape to take home with you. So you're not really missing anything if you don't want to be. Finally, there are books in the bookstore that each of us has asked to be ordered that have to do with our topics. I've asked for Lester Brown's State of the World 2001, and it's listed on this resource sheet, which you can pick up from me later if you want to. Lester Brown and the World Watch Institute put out a book every year, and it's full of articles on slightly different topics every year. One year they might have articles on what's happening to water tables internationally, and what's happening to global warming, and what's happening to pollution levels in water, and those kinds of things. Other years they might have articles on grain production and various other stuff. So if you pick up a copy of that every year at your library or from the bookstore and read it, you'll get up to date globally on ecological trends. That's a wonderful resource. The second thing that has to do with ecological ethics is a book by Michael Schutt, who will be here later this summer. I don't know if any of you are coming back in the latter part of, I think, this month and early September. He's got a wonderful book, which is compiled of writings by a number of people. It's on lifestyle. Now, all of us have read books or heard of books, probably, on simplifying our lives so we will be happier, right? This is not that kind of book. This is a book that talks about the relationship between the way we live our lives and its impact on natural ecology and social ecology, eco-justice issues and human justice issues. And it's also a book that is not so much finger-pointing and indicting as evocative, eliciting and inspiring, getting you to think in a creative way about your spirituality and about your lifestyle and its impact on the rest of the world. It's also divided into very short parts and has wonderful guides in the back for using it in a book discussion circle. So if you want to take something home from Holden and sort of spread the word and plant the seed in your congregation or your book circle, it's a great resource to use, and you might want to just pick it up and look at it and see if you think it would work in your setting. One more book that's really more along the lines of the poetic than the strictly ethical is by Michael Salzman. It's a novel called Lying Awake, and it's about a Cistercian nun in Los Angeles contemporary Los Angeles. So it's about the interface between very traditional spirituality and modern life, postmodern life. And it's also about the interface between spirituality and the body, because like many other well-known spiritual writers through the ages, she has a brain tumor. And the question is, what's the relationship between the brain tumor and her extraordinary creativity? It sounds like a very heavy and depressing book. It isn't. It's a wonderful read, very illuminating and comforting kind of read, a great thing to read in a place like this. So if you're looking for a good novel, consider Mark Salzman, Lying Awake. Okay, let's start with the tape, please. I have a number of things for us to look at this morning, and two sheets to pass down, so I'll just start them. I'll take one of each. By some very different authors, most of them clearly contemporary. Have any of you ever read Annie Dillard? Anything by Annie Dillard? Pilgrim at Tinker Creek, Holy the Firm is what we'll be looking at. A number of other books. She is a very keen writer. By that I mean very sharp-edged. I think she writes with a bayonet, not just a knife. Her images are gripping, but kind of like walking over pointy rocks barefoot. And this book was written when she did a sort of a personal retreat on Puget Sound in a cabin, and is reflecting on her experience of the divine during that time. And her experience of the divine changes from day to day depending on what's going on. She's reflecting throughout the whole book on who is God. And a very striking event happens while she's there. There's a young girl whom she knows very slightly. Thanks. And the girl is a victim of a freak accident. Her father and she are flying in a small airplane, and they have some sort of odd problem while landing, and they crash, but they're uninjured, except that as they're running away from the plane, some gob of igniting fuel hits her in the face and burns her face almost off. And her father's not injured. No other part of her is injured. There's no broken bones. And Dillard is reflecting on what kind of God can I believe in when an accident like this happens to this young, innocent child. So I'm going to read a few excerpts, and then we'll read the excerpt that is on the... It leads into the excerpt that's on the...
Excuse me, so Dillard is the girl with the
Dillard isn't the girl with the face burned off. She knows this young girl.
Oh, she knows.
She knows this young girl.
Thank you.
And she's reflecting in this about it. She's reflecting on angels. At the end of that, she says, "Abandon everything," Dionysius told his disciple. "God despises ideas. God despises everything, apparently. If he abandoned us, slashing creation loose at its base from any roots in the real, and if we in turn abandon everything, all these illusions of time and space and lives in order to love only the real, then where are we? Thought itself is impossible, for subject can have no guaranteed connection with object, nor any object with God. Knowledge is impossible. We are precisely nowhere, sinking on an entirely imaginary ice floe into entirely imaginary seas themselves adrift. Then we reel out love's long line alone toward a God less lovable than a grass head, who treats us less well than we treat our lawns." And you go into the passage on your sheets. Is there someone who likes to read poetic things who would like to read? can go on. You're welcome. Let's see. It's the one that looks like this. It's on the back of the one with the picture of the desert.
You want someone to read?
Sure.
That
would be great.
Is that what you asked
yes.
for?
Yes, yes.
I'll read one paragraph.
Okay. We'll do the
passage. I have nothing, only a truth, that this one God is a brute and traitor, abandoning us to time, to necessity, and the engines of matter on hinge. This is no leap. This is evidence of things seen. One joy, one sorrow, one sensation bewildering the heart and enraging the mind and causing me to look at the world stuff appalled, at the blithering rock of trees in a random wind, at my hand like some gibberish sprouted, my fist opening and closing so that I think, have I once turned my hand in this circus? Have I ever called it home? Faith would be that God is self-limited utterly by his creation, a contradiction of the scope of his will, that he bound himself to time and its hazards and haps as a man would lash himself to a tree for love, that God's works are as good as we make them, that God is helpless, a baby to bear, self-abandoned on the doorstep of time, one mad by cattle and oxen. Faith would be that God moves and moves once and for all and down to the speed like a diver, like a man who eternally gathers himself for a dive and eternally is diving and eternally splitting the spread of water and eternally drowned. Someone else can take it up from there.
Faith would be, in short, that God has any willful connection with time whatsoever and with us. For I know it as given that God is all good, and I take it also as given that whatever he touches has meaning, if only in his mysterious terms, the which I readily grant. The question is then whether God touches anything. Is anything firm, or is time on the loose? Did Christ descend once and for all to no purpose in a kind of divine and canonic suicide, or ascend once and for all, pulling his cross up after him, like a rope ladder home? Is there, even if Christ holds the tip of things fast and stretches eternity clear to the dim souls of men, is there no link at the base of things, some kernel or air deep in the matrix of matter from which universe furls like a ribbon twined into time?
Has God a hand in this? Then it is a good hand. But has he a hand at all? Or is he a holy fire burning, self-contained, for power's sake alone? Then he knows himself blissfully as flame unconsuming, as all brilliance and beauty and power, and the rest of us can go hang. Then the accidental universe spins mute, obedient only to its own gross terms, meaningless, out of mind, and alone. The universe is neither contingent upon nor participant in the holy, in being itself the real, the power play of fire. The universe is illusion merely, not one speck of it real. And we are not only its victims, falling always into or smashed by a planet slung by its sun, but also its captives, bound by the mineral-made ropes of our senses.
But how do we know, how could we know, that the real is there? By what freak chance does the skin of illusion ever split and reveal to us the real, which seems to know us by name? And by what freak chance did the capacity to pretend it evolve? Or is that prehend?
Yeah.
Prehend it evolve. By what freak chance did the capacity to prehend it evolve?
Wow, what's going on here?
This is existentialism. It is.
Yeah.
Oh, it's
Annie Dillard, existentialism of choice?
No, she's fighting against it, but her premise is, do we want, has God abandoned us because we are a fallen, a fallen world, you can put it, a fallen sphere, a fallen universe? Has God abandoned us? If so, language would be absurd. There'd be no knowledge, no communication. It'd be a void. We'd be adrift. And she's saying, no, that's not possible.
But she's tempted, isn't she?
Yeah, and we all are.
Yeah.
Kierkegaard was involved in this, but he turned it around and said, yes, God has abandoned this fallen world. That's why he sent Christ.
Yeah. She's tempted. How on earth can you make meaning out of this horrible event? The horrible event being a child's face burned off in a freak accident. How can we make sense of this? And she's asking this question, trying to spin out these pictures of God's relation to the world, and none of them quite works. And she comes back and says, essentially, the skin of illusion does split. It does reveal to us the real, which seems to know us by name. But does this feel like walking over sharp rocks on bare feet to you? It does to me whenever I read her. She's very, very sharp this way. But then she goes on. There are a couple of places. One of the wonderful things about this book, which I really recommend, it's short, but you can't read it fast. You have to kind of, it's like eating a lollipop by licking it, you know? You have to go through it slowly and read it a lot like you would read a poem. This book is experiments in the divine, different experiences she has, and what the God of the day is to her that day. Now she's talking about another moment. And now outside the window, deep on the horizon, a new thing appears, as if we needed a new thing. It is a new land, blue beyond islands, hitherto hidden by haze and now revealed and as dumb as the rest. I check my chart, my amateur penciled sketch of the skyline. Yes, this land is new. This spread blue spark beyond yesterday's new wrinkled line, beyond the blue veil a sailor said was Salt Spring Island. How long can this go on? But let us, by all means, extend the scope of our charts. I draw it as I seem to see it, a blue chunk fitted just so beyond islands, a wag of graphite rising just here above another anonymous line, and here meeting the slope of Salt Spring, though whether this be the headland I see, or heartland, or the distance blurred bluffs of 100 bays, I have no way of knowing, or if it be island or main. I call it Thule, O Julia Land, time's bad news. I name it Terror, the farthest limb of the day, God's tooth. Something new that redeems the day, but not entirely, because there is the terror that's there. There's another one where she's toward the end of the book. How do I want? Time and space are in touch with the absolute at base. Eternity sockets twice into time, and space curves bound and bound by idea. Matter and spirit, which have been a theme of the week, how are matter and spirit related, are of a piece, but distinguishable. God has a stake guaranteed in all the world, and the universe is real and not a dream, not a manufacture of the senses. Subject may know object. Knowledge may proceed And Holy the Firm, which is the name for God that develops, is in short the philosopher's stone. These are only ideas by the single handful.
I like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thoughts, what does this conjure for you? Anything in particular?
Things being all mixed up.
Yeah. I think she wants to, partly. What were you going to say?
I'm
going to
say, we live in a world that's very hard to know what is real.
Mm-hmm.
And she said there are things that are real.
Yes. And not only that, but God has a stake in the real.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And the real is not just spirit. It's matter as well.
Right. We should have a reverence for it as much as the spirit.
But it doesn't mean that by having reverence for matter, we have to say, oh, well, then the spirit must not exist.
Right.
Right? That's the mistake of the Enlightenment. And she's trying to find a way to pull these things together, which our modern society has not very well managed to do.
No.
Right? To try to embrace them all and to find a language for doing that, that is darn hard to do, you know?
So matter and spirit, then can't be separated, but they have to be recognized separately. And if we are to know what God intends, and I think of them running together, and with the matter being pushed far more than the spirit
right.
terms of abstract realization of them.
Right, right. I think you've got her. You've got her attention there beautifully. Right, that they're inseparable but distinguishable.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And that, we're never very good at that in the West, especially. We're not very good at distinguishing things without dividing them. And she wants to hold them in together. She's got very... This book is kind of an experiment in God and suffering. So it's an extension of this morning's Bible study. If you like the topic of this week's Bible study, you'll like this book. It's thin. It's probably available in the library. And it's a wonderful experiment in thinking about God and suffering. But if it seems to sort of slide right by you on one hearing, that's because it's really dense. And don't think that you wouldn't enjoy it if you had a chance to read it slowly. In Annie Dillard, we kill to eat, things die, life is harsh. And there's a harshness there which goes with these mountains that is interesting to think about. We who live in cities, if we have enough money to pay our rent and buy our groceries and get our kids to the doctor, don't see that kind of harshness very often. Another author that's very interesting to read is Terry Tempest Williams. I don't know if any of you have ever read her work. Anybody? She's a Mormon, and she is a naturalist at the Utah Museum of Natural History. She's written a number of essays. Some are more like classical essays. Some are more like prose poems on the world around her and her experiences in it. She's got a book coming out on spirituality, too, which fascinates me. It's not out yet. It's called Leap. I have no idea what it's going to bring because... As I say, she's a Mormon, and so a very different sort of Christian than most of us here. Are any of you Mormon? No? Okay. I should have asked that to begin with. But she's got a very unusual spirituality for a Mormon. And this book called... There's also Refuge. There's also Unspoken Hunger. If you like this, I would go look her up when you get home. Desert Quartet is a meditation on the four elements, earth, air, fire, and water, according to classical Greek thought. And I'm going to read a bit from it. She's talking about love for the landscape, and she's expressing it in what we think of as quite physical terms. I've got a little excerpt from what I'm going to read here, because I thought this might be an enjoyable thing to take home. But I'm just going to read from a chapter called Earth. This is probably the longest excerpt we'll read from anything today, but I have tried to figure out where to cut it, and I can't, so I'm just going to read it. She's walking through a desert landscape here. Earth, rock, desert. I am walking barefoot on sandstone, flesh responding to flesh. It is hot, so hot the rock threatens to burn through the calloused soles of my feet. I must quicken my pace, paying attention to where I step. For as far as I can see, the canyon country of southern Utah extends in all directions. No compass can orient me here. Only a pledge to love and walk the terrifying distances before me. What I fear and desire most in this world is passion. I fear it because it promises to be spontaneous, out of my control, unnamed, beyond my reasonable self. I desire it because passion has color. Like the landscape before me, it is not pale, it is not neutral, it reveals the backside of the heart. I climb the slick rock on all fours, my hands and feet throbbing with the heat. It feels good to sweat. Some of us have done that this week. To be engaged.
Under better conditions.
Yes. To inhabit my animal body. My destination is Druid Arch by way of the Joint Trail in Chesler Park, located in the southeastern corner of canyonlands known as the Needles. I have no map, only cairns to guide me, the hand-stacked piles of rock that say, trust me, turn here, I know the way. Many resist cairns in the desert, kick them down, believing each traveler should walk on their own authority. It is also true, some cairns have been designed to fool people, to trick them off the trail, so they will become lost forever, a quick lesson in self-reliance, to never believe in the stories of others. But I believe our desire to share is more potent and trustworthy than our desire to be alone. And so I do not anticipate these markers will lie. To walk in this country is always an act of faith. The cairns I have followed have not secured my path to intimacy as much as they have given me the courage to proceed, one foot in front of the other in a landscape mysterious, unpredictable, and vast. Nobody really knows the way. That is the myth of convention. Cedar mesa formations of sandstone envelop me. These pastel cliffs could convince you that you are a hostage with no way out. But the various shales, softer in character, create the slopes and benches to climb out of one canyon into the heart of another. Once I enter the Joint Trail, it is as though I am walking through the inside of an animal. It is dark, cool, and narrow, with sheer sandstone walls on either side of me. I look up, a slit of sky above. Light is deceptive here. The palms of my hands search for a pulse in the rocks. I continue walking. In some places, my hips can barely fit through. I turn sideways, my chest and back in a vise of geologic time. I stop. The silence that lives in these sacred hallways presses against me. I relax. I surrender. I close my eyes. The arousal of my breath rises in me like music, like love, as the possessive muscles between my legs tighten and release. I come to the rock in a moment of stillness, giving and receiving where there is no partition between my body and the body of the earth. There are always logical explanations for the loss of one's mind in the desert. The parallel and intersecting maze I have been traveling through is tortured rock pulled apart by internal tensions and stresses that form fractures in earth. These fractures become susceptible to erosion, creating deep slots between fins of sandstone. Through the weathering of our spirit, the erosion of our soul, we are vulnerable. Isn't that what passion is? bodies broken open through change, we are acted upon. We invite and accept the life of another to take root inside. The succession of canyons is like our own. A maidenhair fern hangs from the slick rock. Water drips, drips, drips until I catch it in my mouth. Drink deeply, the desert sighs. For the next few miles, I simply walk through the pastoral country of Chesler Park, meadows of serenity. The landscape will take care of me. The open expanse of sky makes me realize how necessary it is to live without words, to be satisfied without answers, to simply be in a world where there is no wind, no drama, to find a place of rest and safety, no matter how fleeting it may be, no matter how illusory, is to regain composure and locate bearings. Picking up stones, I find myself adding to the cairns. Elephant Canyon is composed of limestone ledges, turquoise and lavender stairs that eventually lead desert pilgrims to Druid Arch. The vegetation is lush as clumps of milkweed. Their orange fluorescence attracts monarchs in migration. Willows, oak, and single-leaf ash provide cover for collared lizards and towhees. Their shuffling in the dry leaf litter reminds me of all I do not see. Think of the chipmunks scurrying away from you when you are hiking. Right? And the potholes, sinks of water in the sandstone, beckon me down on hands and knees for a closer look. The minutiae of mosquito and mayfly larvae, fairy shrimp, tadpoles, and diving beetles are swirling in its own sense of urgency. Perhaps this is the mind of the lover, manic and driven, the shallow pools of expectation that inevitably dry up. Why is it for most of us the vision of the erotic comes as a rare event? A shooting star, a flash flood, a moment of exotic proportion, and not in stable condition. In this tiny body of water in the desert, I detect waves. I think of the ocean, wave after wave, breaking on shore in interminable monotony, yet witnessed one by one, they can hold us in trance for hours. The afternoon has delivered me to Druid Arch. Nothing has prepared me for this insistence of being. The pure artistry of shape and form standing quietly, magnificently in the canyons of Utah. Red rock, blue sky. This arch is structured metamorphosis. Once a fin-like tower, it has been perforated by a massive cave-in, responsible now for keyholes where the wind enters and turns. What has been opened, removed, eroded away is as compelling to me as what remains. Druid Arch, inorganic matter, rock rising from the desert floor is a creation of time, weathered, broken, beautiful. I touch the skin of my face. It seems so callow. Moving my fingers over the soft flesh that covers my cheekbones, I wonder what it means to be human and why at this particular moment rock seems more accessible and yielding than my own species. What do you hear here?
Like reverse in the reference to her animal progression and
right.
Being inside of an animal is interesting. That certainly
right.
Is aborigine in,
right.
in outlook.
Right. And the earth becomes something living.
Mm-hmm.
And not only, you know, most of us when we pick a living earth, we pick plants, you know? And for her, it's rock that is living, changing, metamorphosing, evidence of the transitions that the earth goes through. It's rock that she picks as yielding and supple and...
rather than her own face.
Right.
That just blows me.
Right. So it's, in a way...
Especially when you just talked about the horror of this woman losing her face.
Right.
You know.
There are, these are extremely different meditations, aren't they?
Mm-hmm.
What sense, I mean, what is the earth to her in this passage? How is she approaching it?
With wonder.
With wonder, right? There are words here about passion, too, really about romance, about erotic love. She, in a sense, is making love to or being made love to by the rock, right?
Isn't there a danger of projecting our values and our feelings and our being into inorganic structures?
Oh, sure.
We have icons. We give them our attributes. We give them human attributes. And then when we worship them, we're worshiping ourselves.
Isn't there
that danger?
There sure is that danger. There's the danger whenever we take any particular image or angle and go with that one alone, right? So for her, and being a faithful religious person, she would never be a worshiper of rocks.
But
right?
I don't know that.
Yeah, you don't know that listening to it, right?
No, I don't.
No, you don't know that listening to it. So this is one angle to looking at the earth for her. And I do want to point out, though, that she's using a very traditional Christian approach. It may not sound like it to us. We have a building here named Agape, right? Does everybody know what Agape is?
Love.
Love, what kind?
God.
Okay, how would you describe it, though?
Pure.
Okay, pure.
Unconditional.
It's unconditional, it's self-emptying, right? It doesn't make distinctions among persons. It needs to grow out of this endless spring that never gets renewed. Right? Or gets renewed only by the grace of God in our case. But there's another sort of love that is a traditional Christian love that is in Western spirituality very important, which is erotic love. Now we all think, oh, erotic means sex, right? Sexual passion is an example of erotic love, but it is only sort of a subcategory. Eros is a love that recognizes a higher or greater good or a completing good in something else and then desires it, like we should all desire God because God is greater, more complete and fulfilling for us. So there's an erotic love then that we have for all things that are good, a desire to understand, be united with, be completed by them. Now, if we focus all of our erotic energy on something lower than God, we're going to go astray, like you just said. Right? But there is an appropriate love for the goodness of creation, which will be erotic because it is a genuine attraction to the good. And so there's something very traditional, actually, about the spirituality expressed here. We just need to be careful about these meditations, you're right. But then there's something very interesting we learn about thinking about the landscape in this way. And as I said also, not all of these meditations are going to be attractive to all of you.
Eros and Greek mythology, did Agape come out of that, or are they totally...
I'm not sure, although both kinds of love exist in the classical Greek organization of love, but there's also philia, right, which is love of equal, in a sort of friendly or brotherly way or sisterly way. So there are there are many categories of love in Greek thought, and we tend to appropriate in contemporary Christianity only one of them. And one of the things we need to do is expand the numbers of loves that we have in order to understand how we can love more fully and how love is not always merely self-emptying. For instance, how many of you, in bringing up children, have felt exactly the same responsibility toward your neighbor's kids as toward your own? No? Is that wrong?
It's not wrong, but it's hard to do.
Yeah, right. And so there's nothing wrong with taking better care of the people for whom you've made yourself responsible in a family, and yet we also need to have care for others outside it, right? So there are many different kinds of love, Eros being one. There's, and the Song of Solomon, by the way,
yes.
If you want a beautiful poem to erotic love, because it's late, I'm not going to read it, but read that poem. And think about the fact that it has been used in Western mystical spirituality very heavily. Okay. Another person you might be interested in looking at, if you enjoyed this, is Sally McFaig. She writes an interesting reflection on the universe as the body of God. What would it be like if we thought of the world as God's body? How would we treat it? How would we think of it? Okay. I'm going to read somebody very, very different now. Maybe you ever read Gerard Manley Hopkins before? We're going backward a bit in time. He's a Jesuit poet. And writes, he has some things in common with Walt Whitman. We're not reading Walt Whitman today because it would tax the Xerox machine terribly. You can't read Walt Whitman without reading pages and pages because he's so extravagant with words. Gerard Manley Hopkins has the same kind of extravagant language, but more concise. And therefore, I encourage you to take these back and read them slowly sometime. I think maybe we'll read just the first two because I want to have time for a couple of other things. Would anyone like to read God's Grandeur?
I'd like to, please.
Okay.
The world is charged with the grandeur of God. It will flame out like shining from shook foil. It gathers to a greatness like the ooze of oil crushed. Why do men then now not wreck his rod? Generations have trod, and all is seared with trade, bleared, smeared with toil, and wears man's smudge and shares the man's smell. The soil is bare now, nor can footfields be shod. And for all this, nature is never spent. There lives the dearest freshness deep down things. And though the last lights of the black west went, O morning, at the brown brink eastward springs, because the Holy Ghost o'er the bent world broods with warm breast and with, bright wings. That one's in the 12th grade anthology and in most of the Harcourt Brace anthologies, at least it was when I was teaching.
yep, and I think it's in Norton's, maybe, I can't remember.
Sure, yes.
Right. So, God in the world. What does this call up for you? Dillard sometimes is harsh, and it's hard to find the hope in her at times. And I think some of you found Terry Tempest Williams to be a little bit of a simplistic romantic. How do you think of Gerard Manley Hopkins? What's his feeling about God and the world, God's relation to the world?
Well, I don't know the author.
Mm-hmm.
He was very young when he died.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking he must have known some kind of suffering. I like that it is never spent. I like that phrase.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel that this man, who I don't know a thing about, has had to be renewed at times. And it's reflected in what he's saying.
I think that his work was somehow administrative, believe it or not. I think he was a director of a school or something like that. Something fairly draining.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you're right. But there is this sense of renewal here, isn't there?
Mm-hmm.
This idea that God never gives up on it, that the sun always
rises. No matter who trods on it.
Yeah.
Like the paths in the wilderness, we trod on them. If we leave them alone for 10 years, you can't find them.
for 1 year. I mean, the lobbying crews that go out around here every week, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's that renewal.
Yeah.
The positive.
Yeah.
Very positive. Makes you feel good when you read it. That,
yeah.
That things will take care of themselves.
Yeah. And we really can almost ruin it, but there will still be that spark in there somewhere.
Yes.
Could someone read Spring?
Nothing is so beautiful as spring. When weeds in wheels shoot long and lovely and lush, thrush's eggs look like low heavens, and thrush through the echoing timbers does so rinse and ring the ear. It strikes like lightning to hear him sing. The glassy pear tree leaves and blooms, they brush the descending blue. That blue is all in rush with riches. The racing lambs too have fared their flame. What is all this juice and all this joy? A strain of the earth's sweet being in the beginning is Eden Garden. And yet before it cloy, before it cloud, Christ, Lord, and sour with sinning, innocent mind and mayday in girl and boy. Most, O maid's child, thy choice and worthy the winning. Phew, that's deep.
It is. It's it takes a while to unpack that. It is so dense. But what's spring recalling for him?
New life.
New life, right. And even more than that, it recalls creation in its beginning, right? We taste paradise. We taste the garden every spring. And innocence and freshness. And he keeps us lurching on through it because he's always ending lines in the middle of a phrase. Most writers of sonnets don't do this, and you notice he does it in both of these. He keeps us moving on. He won't let us stop. He's looking, having us look here and there at the extravagance of creation in both of these poems. It's wonderful. This taste of creation. Now, just to make the point that you don't have to look at spring this way, there's another poem about spring that does similar things but feels extremely different.
And you know what I notice about this, though?
What?
This is not the beauty of spring. I feel in this. Now, it could be all wrong, and I'm...
No, not at all.
I'm bombarded negatively.
Yeah?
By what he's writing about. I mean, the lambs make an awful lot of noise. Okay, who likes weeds? They crowd out. I mean, he's saying through all this, spring is still beautiful. Even though it isn't, we don't find it embracing and we don't find it sensual in a pleasant way through a physical attunement.
Right.
We still enjoy spring. I mean, we still need that. So spring to me is renewal again.
But it's a noisy, wet, messy renewal.
Yes, it is. It's rainy, and it's windy, and it's noisy, and it's bothersome, and we can't ignore it.
Yeah.
You know?
There, that line, and thrush through the echoing timber does so rinse and ring. W-R-I-N-G. The year, not R-I-N-G, right?
That is wet.
It strikes like lightning to hear him sing.
I know. I know. See, it's every negative kind of sensation that we can feel.
Yeah.
It's still wonderful.
Yeah.
This poetic description is about as far away as Joyce indicated from a the flowers and showers of spring, tra-la, tra-la. It's not.
Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah,
where
there's
did
something.
Poem live? She must have been in the.
He was in Britain. I think he was British. I think he's a British Jesuit. Yeah.
Yes.
He's. Am I right?
Yes.
Sure. That? Okay.
Private school part.
Now,
too.
Has anybody know Robert Frost's poem about spring?
I read it.
Yeah. Do you know it by heart?
I can't say.
Okay.
Beautiful.
Nature's first green is gold, her hardest hue to hold. Her early leaf's a flower, but only so an hour. Then leaf subsides to leaf. So Eden sank to grief. So dawn goes down today. Nothing gold can stay. Another spring poem in paradise, but it feels different, doesn't it? The spring comes and I'm already sad because I know it's going to go away. Everything good falls apart. A slightly different feeling, even though Gerard Manley Hopkins is talking about the fall. There's still this love of the messy, wet, uncomfortable, loud exuberance of spring. It's a different feel, you know. This is a wonderful poem. I want to get to a couple others, so I'm not going to read it aloud, but please take it home and read it, because it's another rich, rich poem. Now, here's something very different. We were talking about animals and animal rights and the place of death and killing and living from each other. And this is a 20th century poet, middle of 20th century, James Dickey. He's talking about if life is eating and being eaten, what would heaven be like for animals? Who would like to read this one? Someone read this for us? Or shall I read it? I can read it.
You read it.
Okay. The heaven of animals. Here they are. The soft eyes open. If they have lived in a wood, it is a wood. If they have lived on plains, it is grass rolling under their feet forever. Having no souls, they have come anyway, beyond their knowing. Their instincts wholly bloom as, and they rise. The soft eyes open. To match them, the landscape flowers, outdoing what is required, the richest wood, the deepest field. For some of these, it could not be the place it is without blood. These hunt, as they have done, but with claws and teeth grown perfect, more deadly than they can believe. They stalk more silently and crouch on the limbs of trees, and their descent upon the bright backs of their prey may take years in a sovereign floating of joy. And those that are hunted know this as their life, their reward to walk under such trees in full knowledge of what is in glory above them, and to feel no fear, but acceptance, compliance, fulfilling themselves without pain at the cycle's center. They tremble, they walk under the tree, they fall, they are torn, they rise, they walk again. What does that call up for you? What do you think?
Calls up that you should read it again. It's more than a one-read poem.
All good poems are.
I know, that's what I say. I think it's
shall we read it? Shall we read it aloud again?
Together.
Okay, let's do that. In chorus. Here they are. the soft eyes open. If they have lived in a wood, it is a wood. If they have lived on plains, it is grass growing under their feet forever. Having no souls, they have come, anyway, beyond their knowing. Their instincts wholly bloom, and they rise, the soft eyes open. To match them, the landscape flowers, outdoing desperately, outdoing what is required. The richest wood, the deepest field. For some of these, it could not be the place it is without blood. These hunt, as they have done, but with claws and teeth grown perfect, more deadly than they can believe. They stalk more silently and crouch on the limbs of trees, and their descent upon the bright backs of their prey may take years in a sovereign floating of joy. And those that are hunted know this as their life, their reward, to walk under such trees in full knowledge of what is in glory above them, and to feel no fear, but acceptance, compliance, fulfilling themselves without pain at the cycle's center. They tremble, they walk under the tree, they fall, they are torn, they rise, they walk again.
Misery is a part of existence. And travail, but we get up and we walk again.
What would be the redemption of the world if the world as God has created it depends on the cycle of eating and death and decay in order to create life? That's such a puzzle. Advertisement for tomorrow, we'll talk about it more then. It's a puzzle.
It's a beautiful poem.
Yeah. What a poem.
The third verse down, to match them, the landscape flowers, outdoing desperately, outdoing what is required. Don't we do that?
Yeah.
We always try to outdo somebody else. Walk farther. Be healthier.
It can be a quiet desperation, or it can be
right. I mean, the incredible, you have this feeling of this incredible effort of the plants falling all over themselves, trying to produce this miraculous landscape, better than ever seen in ordinary life, right? And it is trying to do itself better than it ever was, as well as the animals.
And the last verse, I take it, no matter what hardship you are caused to bear, you will get over it. Get up and walk again.
So heaven is not being eaten. Heaven is not hurting. But heaven is being able to go on as before after that happens for them. Right? Never being utterly destroyed by it.
Fascinating. I like that.
Yeah. Good stuff. Well, I have one more for you, which you all probably know. And again, as we've been exploring the feminine and the masculine in the last week or two, we have to be careful that we don't assign any one gender to any one image. So this is we go beyond this poem, but all of you know this, I think. One of St. Francis's prayers. Highest all-powerful good God, yours is the praise, the glory, and the honor, and every blessing. They belong to you alone, and no one is worthy to speak your name. So praised be you, my God, in all your creatures, especially Sir Brother Sun, who makes the day and enlightens us through you. He is lovely and radiant and grand, and he heralds you, his most high God. Praised be you, my God, for Sister Moon and for the stars. You have hung them in heaven shining and precious and fair, and praise to you, my God, in brother wind, in air and cloud, calm, and every weather that sustains your creatures. Praise be you, my God, for sister water, so very useful, humble, precious, and chaste. So rare here, but so extravagant in the waterfalls, right, that are here. Yes, and praise to you, my God, for brother fire. Through him you illuminate our night, and he is handsome and merry, robust and strong. Praise be you, my God, for our sister mother earth, who nourishes us and teaches us, bringing forth all kinds of fruits and colored flowers and herbs. And oh, praise to you, my God, for those who forgive one another in your love and who bear sickness and trials. Blessed are they who live on in peace, for they will be crowned by you, Most High. Praise to you, Lord, for our sister, bodily death, from whom no living person may escape. How dreadful for those who die in sin, how lovely for those who are found in your most holy will. For the second death can do them no harm. Oh, praise and bless my God. Thank God and serve God, humbly but grandly.
Amen.
Amen. Amen. Thanks for coming to share these words. And James and anyone else upstairs who's missed the papers, please feel free. Let me hand you up some. You may want to take them home. And just thanks so much for sharing these today and for reading along, because it's much more fun than everyone gathers in. There you go. Thanks for coming. So you're